So finally we reach the last 150-200 years. And some people argue that Hinduism really is formed in the 19th century and 20th century. I went to a lecture last night on the Wild Lectures on Comparative Religion by a Chinese anthropologist, and quite interesting, but he was again contesting the categories of religion, and he mentioned Hinduism as one of the problematic categories. I got some sympathy with that, but then he was using the category religious. He was making a distinction between religious and the political, and arguing that they both were conflated in the Chinese case of the emperor, which I concede his point. But in a sense, there's a recognition of the category religious, that it points to something distinct from other realms of culture. So arguably within Hinduism, although you can see that it's formed in the 19th and 20th centuries, particularly modern Hinduism is represented in the West, as Pennington says, its roots go back, are older, and it's become the new orthodoxy, but there's no such thing as Hinduism, as it were, and there's no such thing as a religion in India. But I think we have to question things once they become accepted.
Can I ask whether that's coming from the Indians in India, or is it coming from the West?
It's coming from Western scholars.
Western scholars.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Mostly, well, some Hindus, what's his name, the Ghent guy, Balaganga, oh, I can't remember his name. But anyway, he argues it's good that they stimulate thought, but I don't share their scepticism about the category. So anyway, today we'll be looking at the formation of Hinduism and its construction, if you like, as a modern religion. And you've got to see this in the context of political struggle in India. So after the decline of the Mughal Empire, let's just recap. There's India. A bit of Shang. Can't get rid of Shang. And most influences are coming from the northwest to India. And in the medieval, so there was an Aryanization of the Ganges plain before, in the first millennium BC. And the Brahmanic and the Sanskrit influence spread throughout the whole subcontinent. You get the Gupta Empire, which was quite large, which ends about 700 AD, 600 AD, rather. And then after the end of the Gupta Empire, it's during the Gupta Empire that the main formation of what we call, which we would recognize as Hinduism, occurs. All the main deities, the Puranas develop, temples develop, and all that kind of thing that you are prototypical of Hindu, what we call Hinduism, developed during the Gupta period. And after that, you get a breakup of the whole thing, and you get all these different kingdoms developing, like the Cholas, the Pandyas, the Rashtrakutas, right down to the Vijayanagara Empire in the 14th century after that. And from about the 12th century, you get the Islamic incursions into India, like Mahmud of Ghazni in the 11th century, and eventually the establishing, my history is a bit vague here, but the establishing of the Mughal Empire about the 12th, 13th century, and that lasts through until the ascendancy of the British in the 18th and 19th century. And this is marked, there's a power struggle after the decline of the Mughals with the colonial powers, like the French were there, the Dutch were there, the Portuguese, and the British. British were particularly important in Bengal with the East India Company. And there was a battle, which you'll probably remember from your O-level history, the Battle of Plassey and the Black Hole of Calcutta.
Is that double S?
I think it's one S, but it might be double S.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's double S. With Clive of India, this portly gentleman to our right, who established British power in India. And British power is at its height by the mid-19th century, and you get the rise of nationalism in this context, linked to a Hindu revival, or Hindu, what's called, become known as the Hindu Renaissance. And that's the Nawab of Bengal surrendering to Clive. So you've got the British Empire established in the 19th century, particularly Queen Victoria becomes the Empress of India, and so on. And the Hindu Renaissance develops during this period. Yeah, and it's characterised by an emphasis on reason to establish the truth of our tradition. The truth of the Veda. So as you know, in the West, the history of Christianity has been concerned with the relation between revelation and reason, and Aquinas said they were compatible, and said that the truths of reason didn't contradict the truths of revelation. But then by the time you get to the 19th century, that's all reversed, and that reason contests the truths of revelation and rejects the truths of revelation. So philosophy becomes inherently anti-religious, in a sense, or atheistic even. Now that kind of debate touches on India, where you get what is called the Hindu Renaissance, where the thinkers thought that reason, they accepted the Western view that reason could establish truth, and there was an emphasis on reason to establish the truth of the Veda as a revealed text.
Can I ask, in relation to each of those major items,
yeah,
who were the people, the names of the people who really drove it?
Ram Mohan Roy, and these are the figures that we're going to talk about now.
So these are all the ones underneath?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So there's a rejection of images as idolatry, generally, a rejection of caste, rejection of child marriage, rejection of widow burning, and a construction of Hinduism as an ethical spirituality. And this is mostly the work of this man, Ram Mohan Roy, 1772 to 1833. His background is a Bengali Brahmin family, and he's educated at the Muslim University in Patna. And also he studied Sanskrit at Varanasi. He was a very erudite, a very learned character. And he had a job in the East India Company, but he retired wealthy in 1814 and devoted his life to religious reform. And he was visiting the UK, and where he caught the flu and died. I think it was the flu. In 1833, and was buried in Bristol. I looked for his grave there once, but I never found it in that big cemetery as you go into Bristol. So he worked for the East India Company, but he was wealthy enough to have his portrait painted. And his teaching are that God is transcendent, unchanging being, pure being, transcendent being, and is the creator of the universe, which is, he's getting, it sounds very Christian, and all religions differ only in essentials. Religions are one in essence. Now this is, you can see that your popular conception of Hinduism is very often like this, that it's a religion of tolerance, that there's one religion, that there's one truth, and that all religions are paths to the same goal, all going up paths up the mountain, if you like. So Roy was one of the main proponents of this. It's almost a kind of perennial philosophy that gets picked up later on by people like Huxley or René Guénon. Yeah. So it's a very old idea, really. And it goes right back to the Bhagavad Gita, so it's not as if he's making it up. There's actually roots in the Hindu tradition itself for this idea, right the way back into the Gita. So Krishna says, if you offer a flower or anything to anyone, can offer anything to me, and that they come to me. It's a very similar idea to that. That there's all the, that there's an ascent, that God is one, manifest in different forms. So that's what Roy is picking up on, that part of his own religion, his own tradition, but also he's getting this from the West, from what's called deism. Now he says God is known through reason and observation of the natural world. So you see the order in the universe, and you must infer a creator who ordered that world. And the God of nature is discovered through reason, which again you'll recognise from Western theological thinking at the time. And his influences are the Upanishads, Shankara, Sufism, Unitarianism, and Deism. So he knew Unitarians, and he modelled his religion, if you like, his new religion, on Unitarian traditions. You know, so he rejects the idea of, he thinks that the Trinity, for example, is irrational, that there's a, that it goes against reason. So he's critical of Christianity as well as Hinduism. But the Upanishads, he says, teach a pure spirituality in which they promote the unity of religion and the transcendent nature of God. And Shankara is a big influence on him, that all is one, as it were, that there's an identity of God and the world. And he was influenced by his Sufis in Bengal. And deism. Deism was the doctrine, I mean, John Locke was a deist, but Tolland and all these people, John Tolland, Martin, there's another one, I can't remember his name now. Herbert of Cherbury, in the 17th century, who propounded that God could be known through reason, and that God as a transcendent power, you can understand through reason alone. And if you reason about this transcendent power, you get to know it as an ethical force, an ethical spiritual force in the universe that all people can actually potentially have access to. So he was influenced by that deist view. And his aim was to purify Hinduism of superstition. So he's getting this reason versus superstition idea mostly from the West, and he's rejecting, the West put religion under the sign of superstition, and he's accepting some of that, but saying that some religion is superstition and some religion is in accordance with reason. So he rejects idol worship, karma and reincarnation as superstition. And you reject these doctrines because you go back to the sources, the Brahma Sutras and the Upanishads, the sources of Hinduism, and you see that in those texts, these doctrines are not taught, he says. No, it actually does teach reincarnation in the Upanishads. I don't know what he does about that. So in that, you could argue that he rejects the main features of what we identify as Hinduism. like reincarnation, like icon reverence of images. Now he thought that reason leads to universal ethical codes, which is deism really, and the abandonment, he advocated of the abandonment of widow burning and child marriage, rejection of child marriage. Widow burning was a practice, sati means a good woman, so there was a tradition, particularly in Rajasthan, where widows would immolate themselves on the husband's funeral pyre, which was, well, I mean, it wasn't a common practice, but it did happen. And you get these sati stones, which are stones with hands on of the sati who was going to do this act. Now, from an indigenous perspective, there's an interesting article by Julia Leslie called Sati or Sati, S-U-T-T-E-E, in which she argues that from an indigenous perspective, for example, sati was a practice where the family got virtue and merit, was a good practice from an indigenous perspective, because the family was saved, if you like, through the merit of the sacrifice of the widow. But from another perspective, of course, and from Roy's perspective in particular, it was a completely immoral and a corrupt practice that denigrated the human rights, really. Now, he didn't use that term. The term human rights wasn't around in those days. But anyway, it was made illegal in 1829 by the British, partly due to Roy's influence, or perhaps mostly due to Roy's influence. And it remains illegal, although there was a revival of it in 1980s, 1983. There was Rup Kanwar, who was a famous sati, her husband was, he's only 19, she was about 18, 19, but he died, he was a doctor, but he died of some disease, I don't know. But she committed sati, she became a kind of sanctified in the village and so on. And there's a big debate about whether she was coerced into this act or whether it was completely free will. There's a good book by Jack Hawley, edited volume by him, on different arguments and feminist perspective on all of this as well. So anyway, it's still a sort of live issue, really. Anyway, he founded the Brahma Samaj in 1828, and it was modelled on a Christian reform movement. It was a bit like the Welsh Nonconformists or something. And they had regular meetings, and they sang hymns. And they sang hymns from the Upanishads, so chanting verses from the Upanishads. And after his death, there were two figures took over, Devendranath Tagore, who was the father of the poet, and Keshav Chandra Sen. If you want to read about this, there's two books by Brian Hatcher. I can't remember the title of this, something about Hindu reform. But he's good on all of this material, Brian Hatcher. And also Julius Lipner. There was another movement, so that was Roy. He's sometimes regarded as the father of modern India. There was another figure called Dayananda Sarasvati, who was again a Hindu reformer, who had an experience of, he comes from a Shaiva Brahmin family, and during Shivaratri, we have an all-night vigil in front of the icon of Shiva, the Shiva Linga. He saw a mouse. Everyone was asleep, but he was awake, and there was a mouse running over, or mice running over the Shiva Linga, eating the food that was being offered to the Linga, and he was shocked by this. How could a pure god allow these impure mice to run over it and stuff? So he, as a result of that, this is the story anyway, this is his narrative, self-narrative. He rejected Shaivism. And then he left home, found a guru, and became a renouncer. There he is. They're always rather portly, these characters, aren't they? And he founded the Arya Samaj, the society to promote Hindu reform. And he advocated a return to a pure Vedic religion focused on an eternal, omnipotent, impersonal god. Similar to Roy. And he is the one that emphasised this Sanatana Dharma. Now, Sanatana Dharma means eternal law or truth. And the word Sanatana occurs in the Bhagavad Gita, but it's not made much of until the 19th century. And many Hindus to this day will regard themselves as followers of Sanatana Dharma, the eternal Dharma, the eternal truth, which is an attempt to transcend particular traditions or particular religions of, say, Shiva or Vishnu or Krishna, and say that Hinduism is an eternal religion that promotes an eternal law, eternal truth. And there's a character, I can't remember his name, but he's in Oxford, for example, he's trying to set up a Sanatana Dharma temple for all the kind of Hindus. Which is a noble enterprise, but one suspects that people's loyalties are not so abstract. So anyway, his thing is to reject epics and Puranas and what he called idol worship. Again, mainstays of Hindu practice, puja. All of these are rejecting puja, which is making an offering to a deity and receiving a blessing. And rejecting the idea of mediation. So it's a kind of Protestant kind of Hinduism in the way. It's the rejection of mediation. That you can go to the god direct, if you like. There's no mediation through icons and images and saints and incense and ritual. And he rejects the notion of that God incarnates into the world in the Vaishnava Vishnu, incarnations of Vishnu. And he rejects pilgrimage. I mean, all these are so fundamental to the lifeblood of Hindu traditions. But they're rejected by the Arya Samaj, who has a kind of purist notion of what religion is and what Hinduism is. And he thought that a reformed Hinduism could be a force against Christianity. And he reinterpreted the caste system as Varna. So he rejected the notion of Jati, of that caste is something you're born into, but promoted the idea of Varna as different people have different kinds of propensities for different kinds of work in the society. And you have to organise work and have to organise society in a certain way. And the Varna system is a good way of organising society, but it shouldn't be kind of linked up with purity and impurity. And he was advocated the reconversion to Hinduism of low caste Muslims and Christians in a rite called the Shuddhi rite, which still occurs. So historically, many low castes, many Dalits, had converted to Islam en masse in the 15th and 16th centuries, and indeed to Christianity, as an attempt to get out of the caste constriction. And then Dayananda says, well, you can come back into the fold, come back into a reformed, purified Hinduism. And it's still present in India. It's especially famous for its schools, and it feeds into a nationalist politics. So those are two important reformers who... Very much so, yes, it's very much that. It's very much linked to nationalism and a reaction against British imperialism. And it's an attempt, it's saying, yes, really, you know, India is a country that can stand on its own 2 feet and doesn't need the religion or the institutions of a foreign power.
Where about the choice of the word Arya? Arya Samaj goes to the
Back to Arya. Yes, it has a certain force.
Noble.
The Arya, the noble community. But we don't need the British. We're integrated, and we have a pride associated with it too. I think a national pride. But they seem to have inherited the notion of the rejection of what they call superstition. So they recognise that there's superstition in their religion, what the British call superstition, and they want this ethical, rational religion. And the use of the word Arya is indeed significant.
Yes, also within India, within communities, because maybe for Dravidian it wasn't.
That's right. So it's a very much of a North Indian kind of thing.
North India.
Yeah, although the Arya Samaj does exist in the south, but it is very much a thing in the Punjab. The Shuddhi rite was quite strong. They used to do a lot of Shuddhi rite, Shuddhi conversions there.
What is a Shuddhi?
Shuddhi means purification,
okay.
Purity. So the Shuddhi rite was a reconversion of the Muslims back into Hinduism. And the Christians. I'm not sure if, later on, there was mass conversions to Buddhism from Ambedkar. Later on, that was after him. So maybe the Arya Samaj is still trying to convert Dalit Buddhists back into Hinduism, I don't know.
But also between new Muslims and Christians, there were divisions of caste. They still preserved the division.
Between what?
Muslims. There were Muslim Dalit Muslims, there were Brahmin Muslims.
That's right. That's right, it's still preserved. Yeah. So it actually didn't work. The ploy the ploy to get out of the system didn't work. So I think Dayananda was aware of that, and so he thought they could come back into Hinduism through the Shuddhi rite. But I don't think their status was necessarily raised through that. And they still have no economic power, these groups. Another very different character was Ramakrishna, who was a mystic, if you like. He was born to a Vaishnava family, and he was married when he was young, he was married to a 5-year-old. But he left home and became a priest of the Kali temple at Dakshineshwar near Calcutta. And he's renowned for ecstatic devotion to Kali. And he had these inner visions of Kali. And he said he used to see her wandering around. And he went into trance-like states, which he calls samadhi. Samadhi, if you remember from last term, was from the Yoga Sutras, where it means an absorbed state of mind in which you're one with God, or you're some higher state of consciousness, not necessarily one with God. There are different levels of samadhi, which we looked at. And Ramakrishna says that he went into these states. He had two teachers, particularly of note. One was a tantric sadhvi, a tantric female renouncer called Bhairavi, who taught Ramakrishna. And then there was another teacher who came to Dakshineshwar called Tutapuri, a naked Advaita ascetic, who also taught him non-dualism. So he was taught Tantra by Bhairavi and non-dualism by Tutapuri. And he said after this to have entered this Nirvikalpa Samadhi, the highest state of level of consciousness, if you like. Nirvikalpa, without thought construction, without vikalpa. And then he says he had the visions of all the deities of religions. He said he practiced Islam, he practiced Christianity, he practiced all the religions of the world, and then he found that their goal was exactly the same. I followed all these paths and they all lead to the same place. Again, echoing Ram Mohan Roy. All religions are different paths to the one. Kali, the goddess Kali, and Brahman are different aspects of a single reality. And he's proclaiming all this teaching at this temple, Bhavatarini temple in Dakshineshwar, on the banks of the Hooghly River. Now, this was built in the 19th century by a rich Bengali woman who, and it's quite an interesting story, she was, I can't remember her name now, but she was going on a pilgrimage to Varanasi, and then she had a vision and of Kali, and Kali says, "Whoa, no need to go to Varanasi, this is Varanasi." So she built the temple on the banks of the river. And it's a very good example of what Julius Lippmann calls polycentrism in Hinduism. But Hinduism has this ability to sort of pop up like mushrooms. It comes, pops up in different places in different contexts. And so this is the river, this is the Ganges, this is the Varanasi. You don't actually have to go to the place because it can be reflected and recapitulated anywhere. Anywhere can become a sacred centre, a tirtha, a crossing over into the transcendent realm, as it were. And Bhavatarini, the saviour of the world, the Bhava, the people in suffering in the world, in being, is a form of Kali. So it's a rather nice temple anyway, but there was a couple of abbots before Ramakrishna, but Ramakrishna became the abbot, if you like, of the temple, or the main priest of the temple. But his brother came and took over, because Ramakrishna was incapable of performing any actions in it, really, any responsible. He was completely irresponsible in a sense, because all he was doing was going off into his trance-like states all the time. So they got his brother came, or his cousin, and helped run the temple. And there's Bhavatarini Kali, a 19th century image of Kali on the corpse of Shiva. That's her iconography. She's always on the corpse of Shiva. She transcends Shiva. She's with her lolling tongue and rolling eyes. But this temple didn't. She wasn't offered blood offerings at this temple, to my knowledge, in Dakshineshwar. But she is in other places. And there is Ramakrishna. And there is a famous picture of him in Samadhi, and he would go into these spontaneous trances, and his disciples would run and pull him up. But I think this is a staged picture. Because I think he's performing. And his fingers were going to these spontaneous mudras, these spontaneous gestures, the idea that the body expresses dharma. I don't remember which ones are his disciples, but there's somebody holding him up there. But it looks a bit, I think people think this is a bit staged, this photograph. But he did go into these states of samadhi. And he gathered a group of disciples around him. Oh, his Sharada Devi, that's his wife. He was working in the temple for some years. And then he'd been married to Sharada when she was 5, and he was a young man. He left home, of course, went to the temple. And then when she became 15 or something, she left home, walked to the temple, because she knew she was married. It turns up on Ramakrishna's doorstep and says, "Hello, I'm your wife." And he'd forgotten he got married, I think. But she remained his wife, and she became very devoted to Ramakrishna and supported his work. And she became a goddess in her own right after they died. I'm in Bengal now. You'll see very often an image of Ramakrishna next to Sharada Devi. People do pujas to the two of them together. Now, one of his disciples, he attracted several disciples, but the most important of whom was Vivekananda, Narendranath Datta. And these were sort of middle-class, educated Bengalis. There was a movement called the Bhadralok, which was a sort of secularization movement in Bengal that wanted to promote society and promote rationality. And he was one of these intellectual middle-class characters who was attracted by the charisma of Vivekananda. And he underwent various religious experiences with Vivekananda. There's one story of Vivekananda stepping on his chest for some reason. I don't know what he was doing lying on the floor, but he put his foot on his chest, and Vivekananda went into this other world, into this other state of religious experience, this samadhi state, according to Vivekananda. And then after that, he became a world renouncer and wandered India. And he had this vision of Cape Comorin on the south of India. There's an island just off of the tip of India where there's a temple to Vivekananda, where he was meditating, and he had this vision of a united India and this higher samadhi, this absorption in God. And his teachings, which he says came from Ramakrishna, but you could say were repackaged by Vivekananda, are that the divine is in all beings, and seeing others in this way will promote harmony and love. And he's famous for going to the World Parliaments of Religions in 1893, where he was a great success. There was I don't know who started the idea, had the idea, but there's been some since then. But 1893 in Chicago, there was this big Parliament of World Religions. All religions in the world were represented, except the Church of England, which didn't think it was a religion and refused to go. But the others were all there. And Vivekananda was the first proponent of Hinduism as a world religion, and he propounded Hinduism as a religion of unity and tolerance, and a deep spirituality. And he appealed to the West for material support, not missionaries. He said, "We don't want your missionaries, but we want your industry, we want your help to transform India from poverty into prosperity." And he was the one that advocated the idea of the East is spiritual and the West is material. It's a very common, it's still with us today, this distinction. And Vivekananda was one of the people that advocated that. And it's deeply influential on Western perceptions of Hinduism. Now, he started the Vedanta Society in 1895, and he returned to India after the World Parliament of Religions and founded the Ramakrishna Mission, which is still important today. And he stressed action, karma yoga. The Ramakrishna Mission have hospitals and schools and promote tolerance and the idea that the divine is in all beings. And he says Hinduism is pluralistic and accepts all religions as aspects of the one truth. Again, echoing Ramakrishna, echoing Roy, Rama and Roy. And this provided a strong ideology to link into nationalism. So India is one nation, India is spiritual, India, the religion of India is Hinduism, which is tolerance and transcendence and recognises the divinity of all beings. And we're one in essence, one humanity in essence. Now here's I think it's a quite interesting picture of Ramakrishna monks with Vivekananda. He founded the Ramakrishna Mission, and these are a bunch of monks sitting with him. And they look very relaxed. I mean, this guy sitting here is sort of, I don't know, there's something about that picture which is an indication of the kind of the sense of community that they had, perhaps. There's Vivekananda in the middle. And the Ramakrishna Mission still going, and they do a good book series, and they have at Pondicherry there's a library. The Ramakrishna Mission has a good library there, and there's a whole centre for the Ramakrishna Society there. Another one moving forward in time, Gandhi. Now Gandhi. Everyone's seen the film. He was born to a Barnia family in Gujarat. He has a Bhakti background with Sufi influence in his family. He studied law. He wrote to Tolstoy. He met theosophists. He read Edwin Arnold's translation of the Bhagavad Gita, which deeply influenced him. He practiced law in Bombay, went to Africa and returned to India. And you've seen the Attenborough film, I suppose, everyone has. And he advocated political philosophy of non-violence and passive resistance to get rid of the British and to realise social change. Yes, so his pacifism and non-violence, ahimsa, was derived from his own Gujarati inheritance, particularly Jainism. Jainism was very strong in that part of India. And Jainism is a very strong advocate of extreme non-violence, ahimsa. So he's absorbing that. He's also influenced by Vaishnavism, which was also, he was from a Vaishnava family, but with some Sufi influence as well. So there's non-violence within his tradition, but then he's also writing to Tolstoy, and Tolstoy is advocating non-violence as well. So he's getting non-violence from Tolstoy and from Jainism and Vaishnavism. And he sets up this ashram near Ahmedabad, and he advocates Scottish industries, spinning, khadi, you know, common cloth. And he dressed in the standard, you know, the famous way that he did. And there's a famous salt march against the tax, salt tax, there's a tax that the British imposed on salt. And so he said, well, salt is free, it's available on the beaches and so on. And so they marched in protest against this tax. And practice non-resistance, passive resistance. And he's part of the Indian nationalist struggle. He's a leading voice in the Congress Party. And as a consequence of Gandhi and others, there's a British withdrawal in 1947, accompanied by partition, which Gandhi was against, deeply against partition. And eventually he was assassinated by a member of the RSS, which was a Hindu a fundamentalist group, really, that we looked at in our MST seminars briefly.
Sorry, what do you mean by Hindu fundamentalism?
At this time, there were other groups that were advocating that India is a Hindu nation, not a secular nation. So they were against Gandhi's secularisation. And there was a fellow called Savarkar, who was actually put in prison for a long time, who wrote, "What is a Hindu?" And he was linking the notion of Hindu with the notion of nationalist. And he advocated something called Hindutva, Hindu-ness. Hindutva, Hindu with TVA after Hindutva, Hindu-ness.
as being essentially Indian. And Gandhi was against that view, and he was assassinated by a member of the Rashtriya Sevak Sangh. Which was a cultural organisation to promote Hinduness, Hindutva, and another one, the VHP. And they're still in existence. I mean, that would take a separate session to do justice to them. But he was.
He lived a very spiritual life at the same time, didn't he? That's what I found. Rather
Gandhi did.
Yes, because you're saying he secularised it, but at the same time he lived a very.
That's right. But he thought secularisation was an institutional form in which tolerance of Muslims and Christians and Hindus and Buddhists could all exist within this one nation. So that was his kind of secularism. But you're absolutely right. It was Nehru who was a more aggressive kind of secularist, who had this promoted India. We're still living with the inheritance of Nehru, really. According to statistics, Indians are the most religious people in the world, according to the statistics, however they judge that. And yet there's a mismatch between Congress, if you like, the secular Congress Party, and the majority of people who claim to be religious in some sense. So religion is not particularly well represented in the public sphere, in institutions, and there's very little study of religion at an academic level. For Gandhi, God was truth, satya, again, a Upanishadic notion. Ahimsa, non-violence, which he's getting from, as I said, from Tolstoy and from his own Vaishnava and Jain traditions. And Satyagraha, holding fast to the truth, leads to Indian nationhood. A very high notion of truth. And it leads to the welfare of all, the Sarvasudaya. So truth, holding grasp, never lying, never complete honesty, complete grasping the truth, which is actually a very difficult thing to do. I think Augustine goes on about this. And brahmacharya, which is celibacy, control of the self and control the population through through practice of brahmacharya, through celibacy. And he was against untouchability. And he called the untouchables the children of God, the Harijans, which they themselves reject as a being sort of patronizing, really. And they call themselves Dalits, the oppressed. I'm not sure about Dalit politics now. But he advocated an ethical Hinduism, and he was for Varnashrama Dharma, if you remember, the Dharma with regard to your stage of life and your class. So again, like the Arya Samaj, he thought that the Varna was a good way of organising society, but he rejected caste and the purity and pollution associated with it. And there he is, with his John Lennon sunglasses. Now, Hindu nationalism, there's another kind of, although he was a Hindu, Gandhi was a Hindu nationalist in a way, there was another kind of more extreme kind of Hindu nationalism. And the RSS was a cultural organisation to promote the interests of Hindus against Muslims, Christians and communists in the 20th century. And the VHP, another one, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, founded in 1964. And the BJP, which is the development of a party called the Jana Sangh, founded in 1951. And the BJP have been in power twice now in India, and they were kicked out about 4 years ago, if I remember. They were voted in. Now, in the 90s, there was a lot of nationalism, regional nationalism developing, and particularly Shiv Sena in Maharashtra with Bal Thackeray. I think I've spelled his name Thackeray wrong. I think it's like Thackeray, like the author. And he died about, you know, died last year, Baltakri. An interesting character. But there was a problem of communism, particularly in the 90s, where you got Hindu group, Hindus killing Muslims, Muslims killing Hindus, and particularly with the 1992, the Babri Masjid at Ayodhya. The Ayodhya is a place where Rama was said to have been born, and there was a Humayun built a mosque on top of a Hindu temple in the 16th century, which was torn down by the what are they called, Swayamsevaks, the workers for these RSS, BJP, BHP groups. They tore it down. And of course, that caused a lot of riots and so on. And they wanted to build a Hindu temple back on that site, but that never happened. I don't know what the situation is now there. And there were very strong use of religious themes such as Rama. Rama is the martial hero of the Ramayana. So Hinduism isn't a passive female religion the way it was constructed by the British. It's actually a robust martial tradition of manliness and heroism and strength. We kicked out the British and we can kick out foreign influences and become a strong nation, is a message. And that nation, that ideal, is encapsulated in this word Hindutva, Hinduness. And so that's still going on. So you've got the Gandhi kind of tolerant kind of Hindu nationalism. You've got the more extreme, less tolerant Hindu nationalism. And you've also got the Hindu diaspora now, the Hinduism outside of India. So Indians who have left India because of colonialism or various other reasons, getting kicked out of Uganda and all that. And now you've got what Agahinanda Bharati calls the pizza effect. He argues that Hinduism has been exported from India and gets re-imported back into India like a pizza. Pizza was a fairly mundane dish in Italy, so he says, I don't know if it's true, it gets exported and gets embellished with pepperoni.
Very diplomatic.
He's a pizza expert, right? it gets imported back into India, back into Italy with all these, you know, pepperoni and all the rest of it.
I love it.
Who knows? And he says Bhakti is like that. Gurus, Bhakti, gets exported to the West, gets re-imported back into India. And you get lots and lots of, I mean, this is interesting questions. What is Hinduism? Can you have a Hinduism without the society? Is Hinduism a world religion that you can strip from its social context? Well, one answer to that is yes, because it's happened in a sense. You've got these movements like ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. You've got the Swami Narayan tradition, which is, that's still very much, that's not so much a Hindu convert. Not many Westerners convert to his Swami Narayan, I don't think, but they do to ISKCON. And there are other movements with strong Western followings. Ramana Maharshi had a strong Western following. He was an Advaita teacher, a saintly character who advocated an Advaita doctrine, a meditation on who am I. Yogananda, who started the Yogananda Fellowship, advocated yoga in the States, wrote a very interesting autobiography of a yogi, which is well worth reading. And Sai Baba, the one that died a few years ago, with the Afro haircut and the long robes, who produced vibhuti, ash from his fingers. I think it's his dandruff, really. And he was, but again, a very controversial figure because he gets, there were lots of controversies surrounding Sai Baba. Murders that occurred on his ashram and things like this. But, so all these characters are kind of double-edged, really. Radha Swami Satsang in the Punjab, the Radha Swami gurus aren't, they look like Sikhs, but they're not particularly Sikhs, so it's a kind of Hindu tradition, really. but advocates focusing on the master as the saviour, if you like, as the guru, as who teaches the union with God through through meditation, through listening to the inner sound, repeating a mantra and hearing the inner sound of God. And Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the Beatles guru, and that's he started transcendental meditation. That was it. And there are Maharishi Yogi universities in various. I don't know if they're still running. One in Switzerland, Elan Vital. But there was a character called Maharaji, a 16-year-old kid in the '70s. Who was rejected by his mother in the end, I think. But Alain Vital is still going. It's a kind of new age type thing now. Rajneesh or Osho, controversial guru who came to America. All his disciples used to wear orange. And he advocated what he called Tantra. And very controversial figure. But dies back in India, gets kicked out of America and goes back to India. But his ashram in Pune is still there. But it's kind of merged into the broader New Age environment, I think. No, he died about 10 years ago, I think. The organization is still around, yeah. But Osho himself, he says he was poisoned by the CIA. Mm. Probably was, actually. It was
a very good film.
But a very controversial figure. A very funny character. I mean, you listen to his some of his discourse, his satsangs are very amusing. He had a good sense of humour in him. And under my he's the one. He was so his about 90 Rolls Royces he had or something.
Yeah.
But that's right. Yeah. I met his plumber once. Used to know his plumber, that sounds ridiculous. But it's a plumber. He's plumbing in this. He set up this city in the States called Rajneeshpuram. Which is quite a big job, plumbing for the whole of that. And but he would go and see Rajneesh in his room, and he said he had a small room with just a bed and a chair, which is very strange because it kind of contrasts with this image of the opulent kind of guru figure. So one suspects there's lots of contradictions in Rajneesh's persona. And under Mai Ma, she's still going. She's a hugging guru. She was in London about a year or two ago. And, I was invited to go and be hugged, but I couldn't go that day, so I missed that, I'm afraid.
Yes, I went.
You went, did you? Did
no,
you get
I
hugged?
I actually sat meditating with her on the platform.
Oh, there we are.
10,000 people.
There we are, so we'll get her darshan indirectly through you then, didn't you?
No, she's wonderful.
Yeah, oh, good, yeah. And she's a Kerala speaker. But it's interesting how she's a fairly simple origins. And my colleague, a friend, Rich Freeman, who's a Malayalam, fluent Malayalam speaker, went to one of he does work on her. And she was speaking in Malayalam, and then her Malayalam was being translated into Hindi and Bengali by one of her followers. And it was becoming much more sophisticated in terms of philosophy and so on, a kind of angle in an Advaitin kind of way, you know. So she's being repackaged by her followers. And that's very interesting in that process. Siddha Yoga, Muktananda, what's his name? What is it, Muktananda? The Siddha Yoga man. Muktananda. And his follower now, Chidvilasananda, she's taken over the organization. Very big in the States. Went to the ashram in the States. But they charge lots of money for meditation courses. It's £700 for a weekend of meditation. And lots of other Western teachers, Ava Basa Kalki, Lee Lozowick, John Klein, Andrew Cohen, the list is endless of these gurus, Western gurus. And there's Adi Dhar Lavananda, who died about a year ago now, who had an ashram in Mahui in Hawaii. But he looks pretty awful. But some of his books are quite interesting, worth looking at. Love of the Two-Armed Form, and so on. So differences. Sorry, I'm going on a bit. The differences between Hinduism and neo-Hinduism New Hinduism is the continuity with the past is broken. And there's ideas from Western philosophers and Christianity are very influential. Hindu traditions are read or reinterpreted in the light of these new of these Western philosophies. Neo-Hinduism connected with cultural and political nationalism. And all arguably, nationalism is a Western concept that's taken on Indian garb. So I think nationalism arose with an idea of nation-state, which is probably only the last few hundred years. I don't think you get nationalism. I mean, like, you know, Agincourt and Henry V and all that, I'm not sure that we could call that nationalism, really. But perhaps it's, we can, you know, it's an open to question. Other monism of neo-Hinduism contrasts with the theism of traditional Hinduism. I'm putting a question mark by that. I'm not sure if that's completely true, but arguably that's the case. That there's a monism, an Advaita view amongst the neo-Hindu Hindu reformers, which has influenced the Sanatana Dharma movement in the modern world. And many middle-class Hindus will have a kind of monistic view. I'm not sure that's completely true. But the icon is the deity for traditional Hinduism, but a symbol for the neo-Hindus. And neo-Hinduism, there's a stress on Hinduism as a spiritual unity. And inclusivism, which Paul Hacker talked about in terms of Hinduism, inclusivismus, is also a feature of ancient religion, which is also a feature of this modern kind of neo-Hinduism. So there are continuities, but also some discontinuities.
So that's it, folks.
Thank you very much.